Good evening.
Good evening.
A couple of new people tonight. I'm Patrick, and you are?
Jeff.
Jeff, nice to meet you. Have I seen you before? What's your name?
Michael.
Michael, good to see you again. Welcome. Welcome. Well, I just got back from a nice vacation, and I always get inspired on vacation. Everything looks like a kind of Buddhist koan, and so I'll talk a little bit about that. The first part of my trip, I saw a few of our Zen friends that have been here over the years that are now in residing in Germany. So I went to, I saw three of our Zen friends. And then I spent time by myself in Paris. That was my first visit to both Germany and Paris, and it was a great trip. I don't understand a word of German or French, but Europeans just learn languages so well, and they were very accommodating to my English. French is a very musical language. I had this vision that, you know, if I were a French teacher, I would just, for the first month, I would just go, merci, and à bientôt, and parlez-vous français? And we would just do that all day, all for the whole hour. We would just do those few phrases in sort of a musical way, and we'd eat pastries for the whole month. This is why we're really learning this language. It's just so we can be musical and eat together. So I was really very charmed. By the French language. One of the things that I scheduled myself before I left, I got tickets to the Paris Opera, and I was going to see Parsifal. Wagner, his last opera. It took him 25 years to write Parsifal, and 2 days before the opera, I got an email that said it had been canceled. So I wasn't able to see it. They encouraged me to schedule another time, but I wasn't going to be in the country when it was next, so I went and got my refund. And but I did a lot of studying because I figured that it was a German opera, and I was seeing it in Paris, so that the subtitles would be in French, and so I figured I needed to know that opera before I went, so I could follow along. And so I got on Wikipedia, and it turns out that Wagner comes with a lot of political baggage, but he was interested in Buddhism, and so he made his character Parsifal, which means pure fool, a bodhisattva archetype. And I don't know where Wikipedia got this, because Parsifal means pure fool, but Wikipedia expanded it to pure fool enlightened by compassion. And that's kind of our bodhisattva path. Not knowing, but fueled by compassion, fueled by wanting to connect and be intimate. And of course, the not knowing part, the pure fool, is our practice of just letting go, of just telling ourselves over and over again, this is not it. Let go of that idea. Open up to all possibilities. And so we've heard that practice of not knowing in many different places in our Buddhist studies, the koan that ends, not knowing is most intimate. When you've got a pretty good idea of what's going on, just try and let go of that idea and see if you can't take in, see if you aren't automatically opened right up to other possibilities, and that you're a little closer to the situation than when you've already got your mind up. So basically, I'm going to be talking this evening about our not knowing enlightened by compassion practice. That's kind of been on my mind this year. How do I, what is my expression of the bodhisattva path in this world, whether it's walking down Pacific Avenue in Santa Cruz, or Rue de Saint-Michel in Paris. How does a bodhisattva walk through this life of causes and conditions? And I've spoken before about this path being remembering the whole works, remembering not only the data that we transform through our senses. Remember not only, living in this world of, people with names, Corrine and Stan and Richard, remembering not only our differences, but remembering the ultimate truth, the source from which all of these appearances spring. Remember that non-conceptual source, that we are nothing but moment after moment. Our religion, this Mahayana school of Buddhism, is kind of famous for talking about ultimate reality and the absolute truth. Even Suzuki was questioned about it. Suzuki Roshi in the 60s, one of his young students reportedly said, "Roshi, you're always talking about the oneness of everything. You're always talking about the absolute oneness, but my gosh, you're short and I'm tall. You're old and I'm young. You speak Japanese, I speak English. What is this oneness that you're always talking about?" And Suzuki, who was never critical, who was always lighthearted, said, "You have demonstrated your facility in learning and being aware of differences. So I think it's my duty to bring out the other side, the oneness. And if you knew as much about oneness as you do about differences, I would be talking about differences." So that's why I can get up here month after month and give the same lecture about remembering the unity and the oneness and the absolute truth. But of course, that's the other pendulum swing. Our real practice is the middle way not one, not two. We're nothing but the one bright pearl at the same time that we all kind of sparkle a little bit differently. And so that's why I've sort of thought that this practice of the pure fool enlightened by compassion is remembering the wholeness of the two truths, the unity of the two truths, of our difference, the merging of our difference and unity. The practice of the first part of the pure fool of not knowing is, as I said, over and over reminding ourselves, not this, not that, let that one go. Can I open a little bit more? I think about classes in school many decades ago. The classes that I really loved, I really wanted to reach out and grab onto these concepts. I felt good if I finally was able to understand and move on to sort of the next level. So in that sense, getting to the truth or learning more and more about algebra or physics or literature is about grasping on and building and moving forward. So this is kind of a funny practice, this Buddhism, where to get to the truth, we're really over and over letting ideas and concepts go. Not that, not that, not that. It doesn't actually give you an end point. It doesn't say you finally let go enough and you've got it now. It's this continuing over and over again to let go. Now, in all fairness, sometimes in these 40-minute sits, I can really let go. I really can settle in to the unity and the non-separation and the intimacy of all things. But I backslide. But, you know, I might get up, the bell might ring, and I might drive back home. And I've kind of backslid. And I'm right back into grasping and holding on and acquiring good ideas and practicing in my head what I'm going to say to that person when I see her next. So I get a chance over and over again to sort of keep letting go. It's hard to imagine that I don't stay in the same place all the time. But in any given moment, we have the opportunity to let go of our ideas that we're holding on to and see if we can't be more open to other data that might be coming in and become more intimate just in this moment. We don't have to do it once and for all and just sort of get there in nirvana and abide. It's this practice that we've taken on for this lifetime and maybe a few more. Just letting go, opening up, trying to get a little closer to the situation, trying to remember that ultimately we're not separate, even if we think we've got different ideas. And that's part of the wholeness, that remembering over and over again that we are nothing but Buddha nature. We are nothing but the reality body of Buddha. That we are without an inherent self, that we're empty of an inherent self, and that emptiness is something that we share, and that's why we're intimate and not separate, and that is our being that we have to remember moment after moment. It reminds me of when I first got here in the early 90s, Catherine taught the four foundations of mindfulness for a couple of years. You know, 6 weeks on, 6 weeks off, but always coming back to one of Buddha's middle-length discourses, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, where we really practice mindfulness. And one of the exercises was when the phone rang, you just let it ring a few times. And during those two or three or four rings, you kind of got into your body again. There wasn't any particular posture that you had to take, but you just sort of collected everything. You collected your mind, which was one place. You collected your body, and you brought it all together into one piece before you reached for that phone and said hello. And most everybody said, coming from that place of integration, of wholeness, made it a different phone call than when we weren't paying attention to the, at least the unity of mind and body. When we brought everything together, and we were ready for whatever was on that other line, we were open for what us on that other line. What's the line in this week's koan? We were willing to have life hit us. We were ready to pick up that phone and whatever was there, we were going to be open to it. It was a different experience when we brought our whole body and mind to that phone call. And I think that's how the pure fool meets the causes and conditions of her life with that openness, with that wholeness. The whole works is there to and willing to be hit by the causes and conditions of life. And I think you might have the experience that when the whole works is there, when you start your walking meditation, after a period of sitting meditation, you might have the experience of, I feel nurtured, I know I haven't been thinking about much in my 40-minute meditation. I've just been settling into my Buddha body. But now that I'm up on my feet, I feel nurtured. I feel fueled. And it's not such a big jump to say that. That's the compassion that we're feeling. That's the connection that we felt with all the meditators in these last 40 minutes. Or that's the connection I'm feeling with the ground right now. I feel kind of nurtured by this practice. So this pure fool awakened with compassion, enlightened by compassion, is bringing the whole works to meet the causes and conditions that unfold before us. Recently I was out of sorts. I was kind of cursing the causes and conditions that were unfolding in my life. I had forgotten to bring wholeness to each moment, and I was just kind of being battered around by those surface waves, the causes and conditions of my life. And I kind of forgot that the intimacy and the unity that is that is our life. And I had the wherewithal to reach out to a good friend who was supportive and reminded me of my wholeness. And not only did I feel, you know, kind of put back together and willing to meet the causes and conditions again in open-hearted, more intimate way, but actually in that relationship, in that supportive relationship right there, I was feeling closer and more intimate. Like, yes, that's exactly it. It's whole. It's not separate. It's integrated. It's not a battering of causes and conditions. Despite that I'd forgotten to think about wholeness, reaching out to someone that your intimacy is already established is a finger pointing in the right direction. Oh yeah, wholeness. At least I can meet with one other person. Give that a try when in those times that you've forgotten wholeness or you're feeling battered about. I've been doing a lot of walking. That's turned out to be a good form of exercise for me. And a practice I've taken on is just to watch my mind. It's a little bit like the telephone practice of integrating body and mind. But watching body and mind, I'm aware of the things that draw my attention. You know, oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's interesting. But really paying attention to this ordinary mind, which our ancestors have said is nothing but Buddha. Really giving it some attention, really learning about it. In the way that Dogen says, to study Buddhism is to study the self. So as you know, when I'm walking downtown to go to the store, I have lots of opportunities just to sort of say, oh, that's interesting, and then turn back to the footpath in front of me. And that seems to keep me in my body and mind and ready to take on ready to meet life openly. Kind of a walking meditation. And I'm still able to appreciate the spring weather that we're having. I'm still able to greet the people who I pass. Bonjour. But I stay in this body and mind in a more whole, integrated way. In our Yogacara class, just yesterday, we were reading that the Yogacara school of Buddhism calls ultimate truth a variety of names, something like the thoroughly established nature or the complete realized nature. But this commentary by Ben Connolly, he writes that the Sanskrit phrase has three meanings to it. One is wholeness. That's the thoroughly established, or the complete of completely realized nature. And it's got reality in it. It's got this ultimate realm of which we are is the real deal, is the absolute truth. And it's got the third part of it is that it has enlightenment in it. So the loose translations have been of ultimate reality have been like the thoroughly established nature or the completely realized nature. And it underlines for me that idea of bringing the whole works together in meeting the causes and conditions of our lives. And I guess I just want to say, another story about don't know. When I was in North Carolina Baptist Hospital in medical school, medical students are kind of a competitive bunch, and it was kind of lively being among them all, and we had this one. And so I don't know if any of you have ever been in a teaching hospital, maybe a patient in a teaching hospital, where they bring these youngsters all around your bed and you're just feeling miserable. And you're trying to be polite, but you've got lots of bodily fluids that are just waiting to escape right out there in public. And they're all getting this lesson. And typically, they're all trying to be the first to give the right answer. And one particular attending said, "You know, we're actually want to hear people say, 'I don't know.'" We want people to be to step forward and take this all in and be intimate with what's going on here. So I want to hear a lot of "I don't know." I want to hear a lot of exploration and discussion, and it really took a lot of the competitiveness out of it and made the whole group a lot more cohesive. Hopefully the poor patient was a little more interesting and less exposed through the ordeal. But at least among us students, we weren't trying to sort of yell out the right answer and then go on to the next thing. It was really this this exploration. And we could, the discussions didn't even have to stay with what was happening right there. They could kind of meander to wherever our thoughts went. So we were open to a lot of different ideas, and that was the rotation that I don't know, the not knowing mind really felt more intimate and felt like we were a cohesive bunch that were all working very hard to really be intimate with the situation before us. So this don't know mind works outside of our Buddhist practice, although an argument could be made that at the point that we're all sitting in the room, sitting here week after week or day after day, that there's nothing outside of our Buddhist practice. But that feeling of intimacy really was palpable when we were invited to say, I don't know. I wonder what's happening here. We get a chance to appreciate don't know mind and the mind of the fool when we chant the jewel mirror samadhi. Practice secretly working within like a fool, like an idiot. Our practice, let's practice this don't know mind. Let's practice over and over again. I don't know. I know that's not it. I'm going to let that one go because that's not it. Our ancestors said, practice like a fool. Be a fool. Be that fool fueled by compassion over and over again. This morning we chanted the, you know, having confidence in this mind, having confidence in this mind that is nothing but Buddha, trusting mind, song of the trusting mind, having confidence in this mind that's nothing other than Buddha. Don't grab out for the truth. Just let go of your opinions over and over again. What are the exact words? Don't search for the truth. Just cease to hold opinions. Just say, that's not it. Let that one go. Let me settle completely into this whole body and mind that's not separate from there's no separation because there's nothing outside of this vast, open-hearted consciousness. So maybe you've practiced being like a fool, like an idiot, and you have felt nurtured by compassion. You've felt more connected, less separation. Maybe you'd like to share some of those experiences. Richard, you're probably the tallest fool I know.
Well, I don't practice it. I was given it. Yeah. interests me. With emptiness and with oneness and with not knowing. I'm someone who resonates with the not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And also interested, you know, in the mystery that's there, this idea of infinity. But to me, there's a funny little thing that I'm going to toss out to you that always tends to seem to me to be irrelevant. And I think the infinite is always, in some way, unknowably without end. So you can't contain it. And you can't enclose it. And if you say wholeness, then you have to understand wholeness and relative to some sense of nature, but not wholeness in the sense of the I don't know, because you can't have wholeness and I don't know in a way. There's some way that I think you can have an understanding of oneness. I'm tossing it out to you because I think it's an interesting, if it's not addressed, I think it remains a constant.
So I don't want to imply that wholeness means that you've got it all down, that there's nothing, that there's no concepts that you're leaving out. Wholeness means that you're willing to step out of the habits of mind that come up with the same old things over and over again, and step out into the vastness, which in the relative level has a lot more information that you might become intimate with, and on another level just connects you right away with all things, because you've stepped out of this skin bag, or you've expanded this skin bag so that you're open and intimate with all things. So wholeness does have that sort of no limits, that infinite possibility quality to it. Stan, you're an idiot.
and a computer idiot at that. As most of you know, I substitute most of the agent today, which was no different than most of them. We were going to a class and we were running the Borax, Lorax, yeah, that's right. And it was a DVD and it was an overhead projector, and I know a little about it, but never enough. So this is standard procedure now. I ask them, who's going to be my techie? And then they can show me, and then sometimes I can get it, sometimes I need the help. And then other classes, especially math classes, second year algebra and beyond, calculus and geometry. Luckily, the teachers don't expect me to teach that kind of stuff as a sub. So, and when students have questions, then I make a point of saying, who really knows how to do this particular problem? And usually there is someone, not all of them. So, it's a learning experience. And Patrick, you kind of set me up on that in terms of not spilling about my stuff and who I am, but empowering the students to help one another.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially when you don't know.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Natural.
Yeah. No. Thank you. Thank you, Stan. Nettie.
I'll just do a side point to to stand first, but he subbed for my son's class, and he really enjoyed you being his sub. My son enjoyed you being his substitute teacher.
And I enjoy having you.
So there's one place I notice where I do sometimes want to know, and that is the question about, is my practice true practice? Sometimes I notice that I kind of want to know, am I on the right track? Am I being of benefit? Am I making errors? So I'm just aware that that's one place where I'm a little less comfortable with not knowing. I kind of want to know. So I thought you might have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, and that's you know where Zen I think can really shine is because we really do encourage people to check in with a teacher about practice, and they can check in with a variety of teachers and senior students. They don't even have to, choose people in Santa Cruz. They, we're lucky enough to be so close to the Bay Area and all of its Zen centers. So you can kind of check in. And check it out, especially if you think you're on to something really good, then you can be you can accept the congratulations for your strong practice, and then be encouraged to let that one go, to sort of say, let that thought of really good practice go and get back to your breath, get back to your cushion, and just keep letting it go, that's our refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, is being able to come home and check it out, either with our Dharma siblings or our Dharma teachers, and keep letting it go. Martha.
I love the telephone mindful idea. And I find letting go very hard. And I liked the no, not this idea. But I was wondering if you had another telephone kind of strategy or something.
Well, the first one that really knocked my socks off and kept me coming back was, I think, I've the story of the cooking class. I came here to take a cooking class with Ed Brown, we were all kind of chopping, and he told us what we're going to do. We're going to be chopping, and you get the onions, you get the carrots, every so often, he said, I'm going to ring this bell, this mindfulness bell, and you just put down your knife and you just stand there for a few breaths, and then you quietly pick up the knife again and continue on. And, it was kind of social. We weren't supposed to be silent. He was going around kind of teaching knife skills, and people were learning. But that first time that the bell rang and the room went quiet, and I could really feel all the energy that I was putting, you know, out here and out there and watching here and watching there, it all just came flooding back, you know, right here into this one place, right here and right now. It really knocked my socks off. So, you know, we can do that, you know, over and over again. You know, some people say that they will bring all the... when they're walking down the hall to the bathroom, they might bring all their energy into their body and mind as they traverse that hall. When I reach into this particular cupboard to get the dishes, can I do it with both hands and bring the plate or the cup right before me? When I get into my car, can I just put both hands in the 10 and 2 position and just take a few breaths before I, you know, launch out on my journey? So you make a few of those kind of mindfulness exercises to remember the infinite, and it nurtures you for a while. Let's have snacks outside and continue this discussion. Being thy numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow.